Hello and welcome. Thank you for downloading another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, the podcast that you're listening to at the moment. We're back after, it was just a very short break. There was a bit of replugging that was going on.
Yes, there was.
Taking that jack plug out of there and sticking it into another hole.
Very technical. But the important thing is that for those people who have been steadily filling their bookshelves with books that they've not yet read because they've been buying every book that we recommend,
They
will have seen that as a little bit of respite. But the bad news for them is that we're back And we've got lots of great guests coming up.
Harlan Coben is going to be with you shortly. A missive from Dylan Baines here, because you can email and you can tweet and you can WhatsApp.
And get on the Instagram with all the kids.
That's right. Simon and Matt, this is, says Dylan, love the pod, Ken.
Right.
Dylan's in Shoreham by Sea. They talk like that.
Oh, do they? All right.
March has been a little drizzly and mizzly and grey down here in West Sussex, and so I have found myself turning to some good old-fashioned pulp fiction. There's something about Raymond Chandler and Ross Macdonald that really suit the weather, even if their books are mainly set in sunny Los Angeles. I just wondered if you two had any go-to cosy reads or authors for this time of year. Spring is just around the corner, and that means I'll be reaching for my battered copy of E.M. Forster's A Room with a View. Keep up the good work. I very much enjoyed Damascus Station. Thanks for your recommendation. A book I wouldn't have picked up usually, but very enjoyable. Pip, pip, says Dylan. So, do you have any go-to cosy reads?
Well, I doubt I would go back to other books because I've just got so many books that I'm reading at the moment. However, there are authors that I would go back to. So Ian Rankin, this won't come as any surprise. Whenever he's got a new one out, I am all over that. Similar with Lee Child.
Are they cosy?
I don't think they're cosy, but they're certainly, I know what I'm going to get and I know I'm going to enjoy it. And it's going to be, a couple of weeks of just losing myself in that world. So that would for me count as a sort of cozy read. But as far as going back and reading books I've already read, I've got a box full of books that I still haven't read, so I've got to get through those first.
I'd recommend TikTok.
The TikTok?
Yes.
Yours. Oh, right. I thought we were.
Well, I think
going
my book
Chinese
is a cozy
Communist Party.
No. I'm not supported. I don't give any data to the Chinese Communist
from
Party.
Your book. No.
But as a book, I think you could say that TikTok
is
a cozy thriller.
Yes, you would. Yes, absolutely.
Comfy cozy.
Yeah.
And largely set in Shoreham by Sea. I'm lying through my teeth here.
It definitely isn't.
The only answer to your question is I did actually buy a book yesterday, Dylan, which I suppose does fit the remit. I've only read about five pages, and it starts with like six pages of incredible quotes from people saying, this is my favourite book of the year.
Oh, really? Oh, right. Okay.
It's Underland, A Deep Time Journey by Robert McFarlane, who writes so fantastically. I mean, so it's not a novel, but he's just writing about the underground and the underland and life below the surface of the earth.
What does that... So, obviously, we're not talking about the underground as in London Underground.
No.
So
it's
he's
about
talking about
nature, mate.
Okay.
He's a great nature writer.
So it's non-fiction.
Yeah, it's non-fiction indeed.
Right.
So
okay.
Underland, lovely cover. First five pages are great, but to be honest, it's page after page after page of every author you've ever heard of saying this is my favourite book of the year. So
Okay.
At that point, you're thinking, okay, I'll give this
in which case, yeah, I think I will give that a go. A tweet from Nick Wiggins. Love the podcast. I just started Damascus Station after listening to the episode with David McCloskey. A quick note for Matt, who was trying to work out what SDR was. Well, it's mentioned in the first sentence of the book, smiley face, 8 hours into his surveillance detection route. Well, what I would say there, Nick, is that, you know, SDR, it's not... You do have to do a little bit of reading before you work out what SDR is. But no, it's a good point. It is right there at the start. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, email at any time. The address is booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We are sticking with Yahoo. Everyone else has gone, but we're still there on the Yahoos. And also follow us on Twitter, @booksoftheyear. Our DMs are open, whatever that means. Also on the Instagram, @pickanypage.
Do you think Nick Wiggins is a spy? Because if he just instantly spotted on the first line that SDR stands for surveillance detection route, it almost certainly, I think, means that Nick works for MI5 or MI6.
I do have this habit of assuming that people work for MI5. Certainly whenever there's a security correspondent on the news.
Yes.
I always turn
or
to
Jeremy
my...
Vine. Yes. He is so obviously
Jeremy Vine.
A spy.
Have we covered that before? That
yeah.
Jeremy
I mean,
Vine
no
is
one,
a spy?
No one is naturally like Jeremy Vine.
Okay.
He has to be undercover MI5,
yes.
MI6.
Yes. Let's put that to him.
No, I don't need to put it to him.
Oh, do you not?
No, because he's taller than me.
Oh, because he'll deny it.
And he's on a bike.
Obviously.
With a helmet and a camera.
Yeah.
So they have it on film. Yeah. Anyway, enough of this and on with the episode. So here we go, another Books of the Year podcast with one of our favourite authors, Harlan Coben, who has a new bestseller. It's almost a contradiction in terms. It says a new bestseller because we don't know that for certain, but we assume that it is.
We do now.
Oh, we do now.
Yes, we do
oh,
really? Now.
What do we
yes.
know?
Oh,
right. Okay, so you're a bestseller.
It sounds very braggy to say this, but we just got word that it's going to debut at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I literally just heard.
Okay.
So
now we
okay.
can now we can say
wow, that sounds so what a terrible way to start. I'm really
are you
I'm
kidding?
Really not that full of myself, people, but
are you kidding? Well, what's interesting about that is that, you know, you've had that slot many times before and this is your 35th book.
Yes.
Is that right? Do you feel the same kind of nerves or is there any kind of tension in you, as you wonder how this one is going to be received? So then when you get that kind of news, it's sort of reassuring.
I've reached a stage where it's always special. It's always so great. I try to enjoy every moment of it. I never take anything for granted. I actually didn't think it was going to be number one this particular time, which is a real champagne problem, and I recognize that. But it's a wonderful feeling, and I'm thrilled at how people have reacted to I Will Find You. And that just doesn't get old. I think when it gets old, you're in trouble.
Why didn't you think it was going to be number one?
There's another book that was out that I thought was going to had the momentum to beat it. But it's just, you know, like a career in writing, like every other career, but especially in writing, you're either going up or you're going down. You're never really staying stagnant. And so it's just, one day that will happen. And so you're prepared and you're happy about the success I've enjoyed, you know.
Matt, describe the cover, please, for I Will Find You.
Yes, so we've got a darkening sky at the top, but what is dominating the cover is the figure right at the bottom, and he's walking away from us, and he's walking up what appears to me to be a pier into the sea. But it's a very, very thin pier, so it might be something else. And then you can just about pick out a city horizon in the background, and Harlan Coben in white, and then in red the title, I Will Find You, and a testimony from Richard Osman at the bottom, the absolute master of huge twists and turns.
So, who is going to find who?
So, the first line of this book, if you have it open there, but I think I have it memorized by now,
yes.
is I am serving the fifth year of a life sentence for murdering my own child. Spoiler alert, I didn't do it. And so we have David Burroughs in prison. He's for murdering his own child, if you can imagine anything more horrific. And he gets a visit from his sister-in-law who has a photograph. And it's a photograph of an amusement park. And in the background in the photograph, they see a little boy walking who they are both certain is his son still alive. The person he supposedly murdered, still alive. How can this be? So David has to break out of prison with Rachel's help and try to find the answer.
And did that idea arrive fully formed? Is it a sentence that arrived fully formed? Where did this idea come from?
I think in this case, it's funny. Usually I know very specifically where the idea came from. In this one, I kind of don't. But I think it came from that sentence. And I think the idea of, could I start a person in that dire circumstance and still write a novel with redemption and hope and even joy and humor? And I think that was sort of the challenge. And I really wanted this one to be gut-wrenchingly emotional, where you really are riding with David and you really want him so badly to find out the truth about what happened to his son that we are just glued to the page.
Tell us more about David Burroughs, married to Cheryl.
He was married to Cheryl, who was the mother of the... this is another thing I was thinking about. He's married to Cheryl when this tragedy occurs in their life. And he has not spoken to her since he's been in prison for 5 years because he wanted to also divorce himself from everybody that was around him. But imagine, as I was thinking about this idea, I was thinking there's going to be a scene when the two of them get back together. And he has to say to her, I think our son is still alive. And she's moved on, in a sense. Not that she's forgotten her child, but she's remarried and going to have a baby with somebody else. And I was just thinking, that's going to be really cool to write.
Can I ask you about is it okay? You said that he's going to get out of prison.
Yes.
Okay, so... Yeah.
He's going to get out of prison.
Yes. Otherwise, there's no story, really.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to get out, but I couldn't. That's it. That's not a number one.
Very quick.
Bestseller.
Yeah. It's a short novel.
Can you just tell us a little bit how you... Because it's one thing for us to read it and to go on that journey, but for you to invent a way for a man who clearly is in a tough prison to escape. You know, it's a tough prison. No one escapes from this kind of prison. But you have to invent something that's interesting and challenging and thrilling for us. Just tell us a little bit about how you approached breaking him out.
I tried doing it step by step. It's interesting because this book has a couple of what I would call action sequences, if you will. And I don't like action movies. I don't really enjoy reading action very much. The way I try to do it is to be extraordinarily internal. You are David. You can't do that in the same way in a movie. And you are going through the exact same steps he is going through. And it takes a long time. But I sit there and I try to think, what would I do? What could possibly happen? How can I make this work in a way that will feel real and get your blood pumping? And there's a couple moments during the escape when I'm hoping you are trying to catch your breath and racing through the pages to see if he's able to do it, even though you know he's going to be able to do it, because as you point out, there's not much of a book if he doesn't. But I try to always do action sequences, fight sequences, from the viewpoint of the person rather than the camera's outside and you're watching the action. I want you to feel David. I want you to be David.
And even with that prison break, there's still stuff in the book that we're not revealing now, but it doesn't quite. There's something that goes slightly wrong right at the end of the prison break, which again is another little hook to keep you going. I wonder whether it struck me as I was reading it that there could have been a number of places where you could have started this book. You could have started because he's in prison for murdering his child, and one of the reasons why he's the main suspect is he's in the house when the body is found. And it struck me that you could have started the book with him waking up and discovering the body. It could have been with him going on trial, but you've chosen to do it 5 years into this stretch. And you've sort of alluded to this already, but I just want to explore that a bit more. Was there ever a point where you were like, do you know what, actually a more interesting point might be to start from here? What was your thinking for starting where you did?
One of the techniques that I try to do with writing, and I think it's a good technique if somebody out there is trying to write, is try to start your story in the middle and see what happens. Don't start with me looking out the window with a sunset, right? Get right into the heart of it. So yes, I could have started in all those spots, and it might have been a fine book if I did. And my guess is when or if we turn this into a TV series or a movie, they may want to start at those points. But I thought it was just that line I really loved, and I loved the idea that I'm starting right when he gets the photograph. In today's world, I think you have to start a story fast. You're not just competing with other books, but you're competing with the internet and social media and all the other stuff that we waste our time on. And it's while I say technique, I don't mean that in a cheap way. I think that's the way the best stories are told. It's what I try to do when I'm doing a story is how can I start this at the most exciting place, but still have it make sense so that you are into the story? And part of the technique in this case was go first person. So David is telling you what's going on. He is sitting in prison. It's 5 years after he's been put there. His son's been dead. He is at the lowest point he can be. And now he has a visitor for the first time. I think that's a compelling place to start. And then I can give you the backstory later in quick ways and through the conversations that he has, not with long, you know, going back. But that's how I thought would be the best way of telling stories. There's always more than one way to tell a story. I could have probably done it that way. Maybe it would have been as good, maybe better, but probably worse. So that's if you're out there listening and you want to write a book, try to start in the middle. Try to start with just for practice. Start it at one of the most exciting places and don't yet worry if we're not going to get it and see what happens.
Having had that idea as a great opening line and as a premise for the book, did you know what was going to happen? Are you one of those people that plans and preps, or do you just start writing like Ian Rankin or Lee Child, one of those who always claim that they just start and see where the story takes them?
I'm a little bit of both. You know, there's that what we call the pantser flying by the seat of their pants, yeah, and an outliner. I know the ending. So I knew where his son Matthew was and what happened to his son Matthew before we started. So I know the beginning, the hook, and I know the answer. I know nothing in between. Very little. I knew I was going to break him out of prison. But from there, I really didn't know where he was going to go. I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I didn't really even think about it. I knew I'd have police, you know, some sort of law enforcement chasing him, but I didn't really create Max and Sarah until I got to those moments. Those are the two FBI agents who are following him. So each step then, there's a great quote from E.L. Doctorow. He said that writing is like driving at night in a fog with just your headlights on. You can only see a little bit ahead of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. The difference between what Lee or Ian claim, I believe them, very close friends of mine, as you know, I love them both. I love their books both. I do know whodunit and that before I start.
Can you imagine operating their way?
I wrote one book called The Woods where I did not know the ending when I started. That was the only time in 35 novels I didn't know the ending. These four people were in the woods, four kids were in the woods, two are found dead, two are not, two are disappeared, and you don't know what happened. And I had to start the novel just because timing-wise, an idea ripens or it rots, and I loved the idea, so I just started to write it. And about page 100, I figured out the ending. I could certainly, you know, I can imagine doing it. I can imagine doing it every which way. I can imagine trying to outline it all out. And sometimes, some books I outline out more. Sometimes I really am flying by the seat of my pants. Sometimes I'm first person. I think it's going to be like this book starts first person and then moved into third person. Again, not planned. So in 35 books, I will do anything that produces pages. Anything. That's how I sort of live my life. If it's producing pages, good. If it's not producing pages, bad.
So the... Matt read out the quote from Richard Osman on the front about being the master of twists and turns. Do you just instinctively know when a twist needs to happen? So there's one particular chapter that ends almost basically with a punchline. That's how I see it. And you go, okay. Is that an instinctive thing, or do you think, no, we need one because I've written at least 10,000 words and I haven't twisted it?
It's instinctive, I think. Right, but that's part of the instinct, right? That all of a sudden you're going, I need a moment here. I need something to spice it up or move it faster. But it's instinctive. I don't like plan it out saying every 47 pages I need a twist or something like that. And so there'll be at times in the books there'll be twist after twist after twist, and then there'll be times when there's not. And part of it is pacing. So it's very, very fast paced when he breaks out. And I think this book, maybe more than any other I've written, is probably the fastest paced novel I've ever written. But then I want those moments when he's returning to his home in Revere, Massachusetts, of his childhood, to be a little more emotional and to step back and take my time a little bit with those. So part of that is just pacing. And you can't just go at one pace for the whole time. You have to have balance.
I want to ask you, Harlan, about chicken extinction theory, which is something that comes up about two-thirds of the way into the book. So I'm not going to be giving anything away. This isn't a plot point. But I also want to talk to you about how that theory is. I found it a really interesting way of justifying making what ultimately is probably the wrong call. But...
Right.
Obviously, people listening to this don't know what chicken extinction theory is, or might not. I certainly didn't before I read the book. And I don't know whether you made it up yourself or whether it's a real theory. But first of all, just tell us what chicken extinction theory is.
Well, it's first of all, people will do anything to justify their own positions, which is part of what this is. And the chicken extinct theory, I don't know if that's what it's called, but there are those who will claim against vegetarianism. And I'm not saying, again, we're not taking sides on this, that take the chicken, for example. If we didn't eat them, they would be extinct because how could they survive out in the wilderness by themselves? How could they be in the wild? They would just be gone or many of them would never live for even a second. So is it better that at least you lived for a little bit of time and you kept chickens alive by eating them? Or is that the cruelty to animals? Now I'm going to start getting a bunch of vegetarians calling right now saying, what's wrong with what I said? And I'll get a lot of... And it's not a question if this is right or wrong. It's a question of how we justify our own actions. Because if we love chickens, we use this argument. And if we don't like chickens, we use the other argument. That's how human beings are. We do, part of what our human condition is to find our, we find our self-interest, and then we find things that back our self-interest.
It is.
I'm glad you like that, though.
Yeah, no, it absolutely jumped out straight away, because I know there have been so many times where you're faced with this sort of ethical problem, and instinctively, you know that one of those roads that you could go down is probably the right one.
Right.
But it's also the one that involves quite a little bit of sacrifice on your part. And maybe it's not as great for you. But you take that route and you say, and just to justify my decision here. And that's why I love those parts of a book where you're clearly presenting characters. And I obviously don't want to go into the reasons why this theory comes up. But basically, there is a character who has done something unspeakable and justifies it to themselves, saying, yeah, but, you know, what if I'd done something else? Maybe it would have turned out the worse. And you're like, no, it wouldn't.
Exactly. I mean, we all self-justify, don't we? I mean, we all self-rationalize our decisions. That's part of human nature. The evil person, like if you're talking politics or whatever else and you think somebody's evil, they don't think of themselves as evil. They justify it in some way. Oh, well, you know, the other person I would have voted for is even worse. And that would have let, whatever it is, we all do it. And it's a fascinating part of human nature that I explore a little bit and I will find you in all my books.
You've mentioned Max and Sarah, the FBI team who are on this case. I found them immensely annoying.
Yes. Here's a funny thing. This is so great. I just did a podcast with a very famous American named Charlie Gibson and his daughter. Charlie was ran Good Morning America. And he and his daughter were going on how much they love Max and Sarah. And a couple people during the talks, I said, Max and Sarah are going to be like the killers in Stay Close, Ken and Barbie killers, and if you watch the TV series Stay Close, half the people are going to love them, half are going to hate them, and I love that. No one's going to be indifferent to them. You're either going to love them or you are going to hate them. So I'm not at all upset that you found them annoying.
Yeah. Did you find them annoying, Matt?
I did, yeah.
I mean, I think, anyway. So it just makes you even more on David's side. I think I was reading this book, Harlan, at the same time as I was watching on HBO in America and Sky Atlantic here, The Last of Us, this hugely successful drama based on a computer game. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet, okay. No.
Well, there is a scene in it. There is a scene where in the original video game, you'll see what the connection is, I think, is that the two main characters are Joel, who's the father figure, and there's Ellie, who's a girl, not his daughter, but they've become kind of like surrogate father and surrogate daughter. And to get the girl out of this hospital, he basically shoots everybody that he can. If he thinks you're a threat, he's going to kill you because he wants to rescue Ellie.
Got it.
And they did a survey of people who played the game. And of the people who weren't parents, 50% said he made the wrong ethical choice in shooting these medics who were there. And 100% of parents said they'd have done the same thing.
Right.
And there's very little similarity between your book and the TV show, apart from what a parent will do to save their child. And in that situation, your man, David Burrows, will do anything. And I suspect before anyone sort of says, oh, I'm sure I could have done that, we would have done the same.
Yeah, it's a question I ask all the time. This is what all of my books, in a sense, are about. And whenever I have an audience, I ask them this. I said, if I were to ask this audience, would you kill somebody? The answer is no. Would you kill somebody to save your child? The answer is yes. So where is that line? And as close as I can try to get to that line as a writer, that's where it really gets interesting. How many people? What would you do? Is it how about just improving their life? Where is that line? And when you're a parent, and it's not just parents, because it's not fair to just, as though a person doesn't have a kid wouldn't understand it. They do. But there's just a difference when you say that question to somebody. Would you kill somebody? No, definitely no. Would you kill somebody to save your child's life? Definitely yes. So then where is that murky line? And I think about this every book I've written.
What's fascinating about it is that there isn't, there isn't a clear answer. You know, there isn't
a,
there
isn't a straight answer.
Because I think most parents, in the circumstances and the pressurized circumstances that you write about, probably would make the same choice.
I think so.
And Matt definitely
would. Yes, definitely. probably wouldn't even need the child in the equation. Just get out there and do it. We are speaking, so I think yesterday marked 3 years since we first had the lockdown or the pandemic. And steadily now we are getting the books that we're getting on this podcast. If they're fiction, they are set in a world either as the pandemic is still raging or, as yours is, just after the pandemic. In other words, as close to modern times as possible. And is fascinating for both of us to talk to writers about how you incorporate the pandemic into your book. I mean, obviously, the one option is to ignore it and say it's set in 2019. But something struck me as I was reading yours, in that when our main character is on the run, he uses a mask a lot, which in pre-COVID times would have straight away, someone would go, why is that guy...
Very suspicious.
Yeah, straight away. However, now this is a real door that's been opened for thrillers, for thriller writers, is you can have your character put on a mask and no one's going to bat an eyelid. And it's almost like you often hear thriller writers saying it was a nightmare when the mobile phone was invented, because suddenly I've got to find a reason why they can't get out of this fix using their mobile phone.
Oh, I've lost the signal.
Oh,
we're in a very bad area.
Oh, my battery's gone. But it struck me that this in the one of the sort of benefits of the post-COVID world for a writer is that here are the masks that you can have a character wearing. And I wonder whether that was something you've thought about as well, of how am I going to use real life, or whether you've thought, actually, I'd rather set my books in pre-pandemic so that that's not an issue.
I've done both. So here's the problem: when I was writing during the pandemic and we were thinking, oh, let's add the pandemic into it. You write the book, it takes you 9 months to a year, and it comes out a year later. Did any of us have any idea what the pandemic would be? So my fear was, I'm going to be wrong on that. I'm going to be wrong on that call. So the book before this, which was Win, or two books before, Match was different. I said it 2019, as you said, so I would not have that issue. And Match, I kind of also, I've mostly ignored it, because also part of my job is escapism. And so who wants to be back there doing that? And it already feels like it would be dated to write about the pandemic in the way that we would have written about it if we had wanted to place the book in March of 2020. So that was part of it. And then when I'm doing this and he's running through this, he's in New York and he's trying to escape. And I'm thinking, if I'm him again, how am I going to disguise myself? Well, in today's world, what I would do is I would put on a surgical mask. So I just sort of used that. I don't think I'll use it again, or hopefully, inshallah, I'm not going to use it again because we won't be needing them, but if we are, so I'm just using every tool at my disposal, but I don't really want to explore, and there's other people will explore it in nonfiction ways and doing some kind of dystopian kind of novels. That's not what I do. I didn't really want to explore the pandemic in that way, mostly because I just didn't know where it was going to go and needed anybody else. So if I'm writing a book and it comes out a year or two later, I think I would get it all wrong. So...
Well, there's some moments during lockdown, and obviously the American experience was similar in some ways and different to ours. You had a slightly different head of state who was making some very interesting decisions. Were there any times for you, Harlan, when you thought, how do I write about normal life now? Because we genuinely don't know what normal life is going to be about.
Yeah, I do. And there's been other times that I've had this in my career where when I was in a personal tragedy would hit where I would say, how do I make myself care about these characters when something bigger has happened to me or whatever else? That's part of just writing. And so what for a while I was also frozen. Like when people said, oh, you had all this time, to write, but it was hard to care about what I was going to write when you thought maybe the world was going to end. You just didn't know where this was going. It just becomes something you sort of feel out and do. But I tried to stay away from it as much as I could.
as Matt says, the mask is the perfect thing just for the moment. Most people will find they've got a coat from last winter. They put their hand in the pocket. Oh, I've got a mask.
Right.
There you go. It's absolutely perfect. Right. You've mentioned the adaptations of your books already. I can't think of any other author who has such a fantastic record of their books turning up on our screens and we see the stories happening all over again. There must be part, oh, you've been asked this before, must be part of you that, as you've written this book, for example, that thinks, well, I'm kind of certain this is going to end up on Netflix or Prime Video or something. This character, that's going to be Richard Armitage. You know, that you're seeing it, you're visualizing it. Does that change the book at all?
This will sound like a self-serving answer, but I am, you know, there's no reason at my stage of my career not to be completely honest. I don't think that way. I think the biggest mistake I can make as a writer, which is why I'm so careful about it, is if I write a book thinking, ooh, this is going to make a really great series. It's the kiss of death. And if you're a writer out there, don't think that way. The two caveats to that for me are I make vast changes and I don't care about being, I think the worst adaptations, and maybe the reason why the adaptations have worked is, I think the worst adaptations in thriller world especially are the ones that stay slavishly devoted to the text. I have changed many, many things, and the decisions have always been mine. So the stranger in the book was a nerdy white guy. In the series, it was Hannah John Kamen. I've changed locations. I've changed story. I've added different new plots. I've had extra twists in the end. I'm all in favor of that. So I don't have to worry that, will this book translate well? Because I can change everything I want and I will find you. I don't believe that I have to stick with it. The other thing is that, you know, people our age, when you ask a writer what's their influences, and they start going into, Dostoevsky, Proust, I mean, that's such nonsense. Yes, so of course we all read them and we love them, but we grew up on TV. So we do think, and I think a lot of the writers think, you when you're talking to writers, you're not saying to me, I like this chapter. You're saying, I like this scene. Mm. Because we think cinematically. And to deny that is nonsense.
I think that's really interesting, because we had, as Simon's already said, we've had Lee Child on a number of times, and he makes a point of saying, I can always spot writing where someone has written it thinking, oh, this will get made into a telly.
It's a big mistake.
And it's a huge, you say, a massive mistake. I want to talk to you about, another author we've had on recently was Linwood Barclay, who talked about how he inhabits a world of what ifs. In other words, in his normal everyday life, he is constantly going, if she had turned a different way, or that had happened when she'd got onto that plane, that will turn into an amazing premise for a book. And it struck me that that might be something that you would have sort of common ground on that as well.
Very common ground. I mean, all fiction writing for me is asking what if. Every idea I've ever come up with, I'll give you some specific examples, are what ifs. I walk around, my default life position is asking what if. Where's the sliding door? What could have happened instead? How can I take a small moment and change it around? How can I turn left at the fork in the road instead of right and change everything about the rest of this person's life? All the time. I wrote a book recently called The Match and the Boy from the Woods. There were a series of the character named Wild. And the what if there was, I was hiking through the woods with my family. I hate hiking. I don't really get it. Everyone's into hiking now. To me, I'm sitting there like, I like walking through the streets. I like walking through London and seeing shops and people and browsing bookstores. But I'm like, oh, there's a tree. There's another tree. There's another tree. Who the fuck cares after a while? And I'm whining like this. It's hot and I'm looking for a drink and where's the restaurant? And I'm whining like this with my kids. And all of a sudden I see a little boy walking on a parallel path. He's like 5 or 6 years old. And I think, what if? What if this kid just came out of the woods right now and said, I've always lived in these woods. I don't remember any parents. I don't remember any life before that. And he never finds out how he got there. 30 years pass, he still doesn't know. And now he gets a match on a DNA test and is going to get the answers. That's an example of what I mean by a what if.
That sounds like a muscle, that the more you use it, the more you've got a what if muscle. And the more you exercise that muscle, you'll probably walk out of these studios and something will happen. You go, oh, okay.
All the time. 90%. 98%, 99% of them I dismiss. They're not good enough to be a story. And then some will get through. It's like winning a second-tier lottery ticket. Some will get through that to the next level. And then I'll think, is this just a story or is this just a cute what if? Oh, wait, this is an idea. Can I think of an ending for this idea? Oh, I thought of an ending for this idea. Do I now want to live with this? And is it going to be interesting to spend 9 months to a year writing it? And will the right readers think that? So all these steps an idea has to get through, it's like sperm heading toward the egg. Most of them just die on the way and one manages to get through.
How many stories do you have running in your head at the moment?
In terms of novels, only one. But there'll be 25 different things I want to do in a novel. When I was writing Wind, for example, I started running to like an art heist, like the Gardner Museum heist where they never found the Rembrandts. And then I said, what about it? I always want to do a hoarder. Guy who's hoarder and they find him dead in a rich apartment. Oh, I always wanted to do a 60s radical. Oh, I always wanted to do a Patty Hearst type kidnapping. All that ended up in one book. So, but in terms of books, I only have one. I can only work at one novel at a time. TV is different. I can space myself out a little bit more and do more than one TV show at a time.
Just want to ask you one more question. There'll be more with Harlan when we do our Q&A, which will be available for you in a few days. And I think I'm paraphrasing Ian Rankin here, and I think I've remembered it pretty much right. He says the whole process about writing and then publishing and then advertising, the bit that he likes the least is the bit where you go through and go said, exclaimed, I don't know, shouted, murmured, you know, and just try to come up with different ways of people saying things in dialogue. Would that be right for you? What would be your least favorite and favorite bit of the whole process?
I'm a big fan of the quote that everybody gets credit for, but I think Dorothy Parker said it originally, I don't like writing, I like having written. I really love the creation. I love the fact, like, you know, if you paint the painting all day and the canvas is still blank, did you really enjoy painting? I don't think so. I love creating. I love the fact that I love right now when these characters, David and Rachel and Cheryl and Max and Sarah, come to life in a person's head unique from everybody else's. To me, a writer who writes a book and it's not read is not a writer. I don't mean that meanly, but if you're the person who says, oh, I write only for myself, I don't care if anyone reads it, that's like saying I talk only to myself. It's like you guys doing this podcast for nobody. It doesn't make any sense. So this is the part, you know, for me that's exciting because now these characters are coming to life. So this actually is my favorite part. I enjoy editing sometimes. I like taking a story that I think is taking that ugly stone out of the ground and now turning it into something that is beautiful and valuable, I hope. I don't do that specifically, he said, she said, where that's the part that annoys me. My last step that I do in a book is I sit in a book room alone and I read it out loud to myself. It's like listening to a music piece for a false note. That's sort of hard, and reading it again gets sort of hard. But there's no part that I really don't enjoy, other than when I get stuck, which happens all the time. You know, it's like, oh, God, where does he go now? He's escaped prison. What is he going to do? How can he possibly get away this time? You know, that's the part that I find hard.
Harlan Coben's latest book is I Will Find You. There'll be more with Harlan on our Q&A. We'll be with you in a few days. But Harlan Coben, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Great seeing you guys. Thank you so much for having me.